Thank you. My name is Lisa. I am alcoholic. Very grateful and happy to be with you all. For me, it's morning. For you, it's evening. But today, this day, and you know, this Zoom thing is so wild, and it's been such a trip, and it's just blown my world completely open, you know, and getting to go to groups all over the world and see how you guys are doing it. And I am sorry to say that a few years ago, I was one of those people who really liked to talk about how AA was, you know, struggling and not like we used to do it in 1937, even though I was born in 1988. And I have to say, Zoom has shown me that AA is alive and well all over the world, and there are groups that are just shutting it down and killing it. And you know, there are a couple of people here who are in my sponsorship family, and I know that they are very, very engaged in this process and very engaged in living a life in service of others. And I'm very, very grateful that I even get to be a part of it, you know. And when I think about the life that I had before I got to AA, you know, it's just, I don't even relate to the person that I used to be. And it's really just very, very moving that I have made it this far. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm on some sort of, you know, reality television show, and I've made it into the final round of people who get eliminated. And I just look around and think, how did I make it this far? And, you know, why am I still sober? And hopefully I can answer a couple of those questions. But I think it is important for me to just recognize the fact that it is truly miraculous that I am sitting here before all of you today. So my sobriety date is December 31st of 2005. That was not a good day. On that day, I was in a kiddie prison in Utah, and I had been there for 3 months, and I was still getting high while I was there. It's actually fairly easy to get drunk, to get high in prison. I don't know if any of you guys have ever done that, but it's fairly easy to do. And I had this bottle of nail polish remover stashed under my mattress, and I used to just, you know, gulp it or whatever. And I had this image in my mind that I would be like wearing an Armani suit and drinking martinis in a jazz bar, and instead I was chugging nail polish remover in a mental institution. So it didn't really work out the way I thought it was going to. I'm not a classy alcoholic. I'm not a classy drunk. You know, I'm a very pathetic drunk. I'm a bottom of the barrel gutter drunk. And I had had several sobriety dates up until that point. I had spent the last 3 years in and out of AA, in and out of other 12-step fellowships, non-12-step fellowships, picking up desire chips, and I could never string together more than a few days of sobriety. And when people would stand up and say they had a year, it was like, whatever, that doesn't even mean anything to me. But when people stood up and said that they had 30 days of sobriety, I would go, oh my God, how did you do that? I couldn't imagine going 30 days without a drink. I couldn't imagine going a week without a drink. I mean, I drink, and you know, you don't have to do this to be an alcoholic. It's just my story. But you know, I started off drinking in the mornings, and I couldn't imagine waiting till like 1 o'clock in the afternoon to start drinking. Like, I heard that was kind of early when I was like a year sober, and I was like, oh my God, how long do you have to wait? Like, I'm not supposed to drink at noon. I'm not supposed to drink at 10 a.m. I'm not, you know, I have to start off my day, you know, Jack Daniels and cornflakes. Like, that's how I started my day, because I was so uncomfortable in my own skin, and I didn't know what else to do with myself. I had no tools. I had no coping skills for life. And I was a very, very uncomfortable person. You know, I never felt comfortable. And so that's my sobriety date. And I like to say that it's not my first, but that's not even really true, because I never actually stopped before, you know. I had this calendar, and I would put my sobriety date like every 3 days and cross it out and write another one and cross it out and write another one. And you know, I mention that because my sponsor likes to say that I'm really just here to talk to two people, and it's none of my business which of you are those two, but one of those people is the person who for some reason cannot get this thing and has been in and out of AA forever and doesn't know why you can't get this thing and why everyone else seems to be able to stay sober and you just can't, because you're me. Like, I didn't understand why everyone else could just stay sober and I just couldn't, you know, that I was like, I'm not like you people in AA. Like, I don't stop drinking, not even long enough to have dry time, not even long enough to understand what happens to me when I stop drinking. I can't even stop long enough to see if I can stay stopped. So, you know, if there's anyone here who's like that, you know, welcome. And I hope that I can, you know, bring you some hope that maybe this thing can work for you too. And the other person that I'm here to talk to is the man or woman who's leaving Alcoholics Anonymous, because you are also me. I hit a bottom, which I'll come back to later, at 4 years sober, where I was about to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. And where the things that had been working for me for the first 4 years were no longer working. And anyone who's just, you know, just not feeling it or just not in a good place for whatever reason, you know, sometimes I think we can get so hung up on talking about how great everything gets that we don't give people permission to struggle in sobriety. And, you know, I just want to say, if you're struggling in sobriety for whatever reason, like, that's okay, you know, and just stay, like, just stick, you know, it's not forever. It's not forever. And you're also me, and I'll come back to that later. Yeah, so my sobriety date is December 31st, 2005, and my home group is the Big Book Comes Alive group in Northeast Los Angeles. Again, not my first. I've had a lot of home groups. I've lived in a lot of places in the time I've been sober, and in about 10 different countries. Not going to mention my home groups and all of those, but if you're going somewhere, let me know, and I'll get you hooked up. So please come see us. We meet Sundays at 5 o'clock. So I'm going straight to my home group after this. I am the Zoom chair. I was really excited about that at first. Now I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to do the service position anymore. But that's when service really becomes magical, when you really don't want to do it and you keep doing it anyway. And I love my home group. And I have a sponsor named Bob D, who lives in Las Vegas. And since this is being recorded, I'll say that I love my sponsor, and I don't call him enough. But that man knows absolutely everything about me, and I do not keep secrets from him. And he's very different than any sponsor I had before. I was 7 years sober when I switched to him, and he was previously my great-grand sponsor. And I felt like I kind of like climbed the ladder a little bit. You know, I was like, you know, let's just cut out the middleman and like just go to the source here. But he has a tendency to just be very direct and very blunt. And sometimes he'll say these things that I'm just like, I think that I need a new sponsor. But then when I turn it over in my head for a few days, I start to think, you know, I bet my family has wanted to say that to me for a really long time. You know, I bet my friends really want to say that to me whenever I go to them for advice, but they don't have the, you know, whatever, the courage to say it, or they're afraid of hurting my feelings. And he's like, you know what, kiddo, like, your friends can care about your feelings. I've got to care about your life. And you can go around to all these different people and they'll all tell you, like, you know, what a jerk off that other person was. I'm going to tell you what a jerk off you are. And you need to go make amends. And I'm very grateful for that. You know, and like I said, it was jarring at first, but but I want to be well, you know? And so I need someone who will tell me how to get well, even if it's painful when I hear it, or it's uncomfortable when I hear it. Like, I'm very grateful that there's someone who's as invested in me getting well and being well as I am, maybe even more so some days. Anyway, so that's my home group and my sponsor. So let me tell you a little bit about what I was like before I got sober. I was born in Los Angeles, and I like to say that things went downhill from there. I never had any period of my life where I was happy or where things were going well. I had very weird parents who suffered from a lot of untreated everything, alcoholism, fill in the blank, unresolved childhood from their childhoods, from their childhoods, and so on, intergenerational, blah, 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 blah. And my dad and stepmom were very violent, and they, like, passed me around to their friends and stuff, and a big part of that was alcohol from a very, very young age, from little girl, before I could even, you know, see over the table. I was given hard liquor, I was given vodka, which is wonderful stuff, by the way, it's divine. I adore vodka. And I can remember, like, I want to say I can remember my first drink, but I don't even know if that's true, because every couple of years I'll remember one that I had before that. So I'm like, I don't know. But the drink that I consider to be my first drink when I look back at it, I can remember feeling like there was a knot in my chest that just sort of unwound when I took that drink. And it was like I didn't know that there was something within me that needed to be relieved until I felt it being relieved. But I felt my fists unclench, I felt my shoulders drop, and it felt like I could just go, like I could just exhale and breathe. And I thought, well, you know, screw playing in the sandbox. Like, this is my idea of a good time. This is what I'm going to do every day, like, for the rest of my existence. I'm going to drink as much as I can, whenever I can, and I don't care, like, I don't care what it tastes like. I don't care if it's good for me or bad for me or like any of that other stuff or how many calories it has. You know, I drank rubbing alcohol. I drank vanilla extract. You know, I drank anything I could get my hands on. And, you know, it's interesting because I used to tell that story and like, and I would say like, I watched my older sister take this shot of vodka and she spat it out and said, that's disgusting. Why do adults do that? And that's how I know I'm an alcoholic and she's not. But now my sister drinks alcoholically. So, you know, I don't know. I just, some people are born alcoholic. Some people become alcoholic later in life. You know, it's really none of my concern whether that happened that way or this way. You know, all I know is that I drank alcoholically from the start and that you don't have to relate to that to be alcoholic. Like you could have some years where things were going really well or where you were able to drink it and put it down, or as long as you have this physical allergy now. But I believe I was born with this physical allergy to alcohol. And I didn't know that that's what that was. I didn't know that I didn't drink like most 6-year-olds. I didn't know that like most people take a drink and they can stop, you know, like I drank and I wanted more. And I never felt like I had enough to drink. I never felt like I arrived at a place where I could say, like, oh, I'm good. Like, this is enough, you know? I never felt drunk enough. And I struggled with this in early sobriety when people would talk about the allergy. I didn't totally know if it applied to me because people would say things like, I went out intending to have one drink and I ended up having 10. I was like, why would you intend to have one drink? Like, who takes one drink? You know, I've always drunk with the intention of getting rip-roaring, you know, clinging to the floor, holding on, like trying to signal to someone to bring me another drink. Like that's always how I've intended to drink. And my sponsor, bless his heart, you know, was like, well, that's always how he puts it. He goes, well, it's like, did you ever feel like you had enough to drink? And I was like, are you kidding me? Like not once in my entire life have I had enough to drink. He's like, well, that's, you're probably alcoholic then, you know, like that's what the allergy is that when I drink, I want more. It sets off this phenomenon of craving. It rises to my head and I'm like more, 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 more. And again, not everybody has that right at the beginning. Some people just have it towards the end, but I had it right at the beginning. And that was a pretty, pretty bad combination to be a very uncomfortable little child, who never feels drunk enough. And sorry, my cat's like trying to get attention. I liked the drama of that. I liked I liked the chaos, you know, I liked the idea that I was, like, a 6-year-old alcoholic. Like, I thought that was very dramatic. And I noticed that when I said that to people, like, when I said that to adults, they looked very shocked. And I really liked that feeling of shocking people or getting people's attention or just getting people to pay attention to me. You know, but I loved the chaos and I loved the drama. And, you know, out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I don't want to go into super details about the rest of the stuff I did over the next 11 years, but I did a lot of stuff. And I was involved in some very shady activity. And I believe that I react to anything that has dopamine, adrenaline, serotonin, the same way that I react to alcohol, that I do it alcoholically, that I don't do it a little bit here and there, that I'm a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that I never feel like I've had enough. And when I was 13 years old, I was like, well, I really don't want to be dependent on anyone else anymore. So I'm just going to start manufacturing my own supply. And in 2001, you could do that fairly easily. There were certain chemicals that you could buy at the hardware store and no one would bat an eye. Now you can't do that. Now there are all these regulations. But this was before, you know, Breaking Bad and all that stuff. And I love that, you know, our founders manufactured their own supply, that Dr. Bob talks about, you know, making liquor during prohibition, and Bill Wilson talks about bathtub gin, and that they all drank during prohibition, and like that didn't stop them from drinking, that they just made their own liquor. I love that. Oh my God. I love our founders. I relate to both of them. I hear people say, oh, I'm more like Dr. Bob. Oh, I'm like more like Bill Wilson. Like, dude, I love both of them, man. I totally relate to both of them in their own way. And I started manufacturing my own supply, and I started selling it to some of the other junior high kids. And, like I said, I got involved in some very, some very nefarious, very shady activity. And when I see like 13-year-olds now, I'm like, you're children, you know, you're little children. But I thought I was a grown adult. You know, I thought that made me very worldly. And I was hanging out with people who were, you know, 26 and giving me all kinds of substances, which, you know, looking back, it's like, that makes me more like a scumbag or, you know, than like someone who's cool and worldly. But, you know, I thought that it made me cool and worldly. And I had very distorted values and I had a very distorted view of the world. And, you know, Clancy talks about that, the disease of perception, that I just see things a little bit whack. You know, I don't have an accurate picture of my life, and that's why I need you guys, and that's why I need a sponsor. And sometimes even sponsees to hold up a mirror and show me like how distorted my picture of my life is. But I was very, very, very unhappy. And the first time I tried to kill myself, I was 12 years old, and I can't tell the story without laughing. I tried to drop a hairdryer in the bathtub, and that doesn't work. They put like a safety on it. It disconnects. The reason I can't tell that story without laughing is because that's how I met my ex-husband. Is I told that story in a meeting, and he was the only one who laughed, and so it was love, because he had also tried to kill himself that way, and so it was destined for us to be together, right? Oh, some of you guys are nodding. Some of you guys have done that. Okay. it didn't work out, by the way. But that was the first time I tried to kill myself. And obviously it didn't work. And it's funny when I say that I love the drama and the chaos, it was like, that was so anticlimactic. It was just like, okay, well now what? You know, like nothing happened. All that happened was the hairdryer broke. And I was like, well, okay, what's for dinner? You know, like, on to the next thing, you know. I think I'm living this like Game of Thrones, you know, fantasy, and instead I'm just living like a sad little after school special. but when that didn't work, you know, I tried some other methods, and I ended up in California with something called the 5150, which is a 72-hour hold in a psychiatric facility. And on my 15th birthday, I was checked into my, that's my laundry, in my first psychiatric facility. And I have to say that I loved the psych ward. And the reason that I liked it was because, first of all, they give you a lot of substances. They give you these little Dixie cups with like every color of the rainbow. And I really liked that. And I liked the idea that I was completely separated from my life. You know, it was like, I'm on Earth, but I'm totally removed from it. I don't have to worry about any of that other crap. Like, I can just be my sick self. I don't have to like live my life. And that became a little pattern for me. I could not function in the real world. And the only place that I felt kind of okay was when I was in a hospital or an institution. And I intentionally did things to get myself put back into institutions, and to the point where, like, my mother was like, you know what, Lisa, you can't go to the psych ward anymore. You have to actually, like, live your life and face your problems. And, like, I would, like, call the phone operator and try to get put into the psych ward, and they were like, oh, it's Lisa. Like, no, hang up. And, yeah, and it just... I developed a very serious incarceration problem. You know, I could not function without someone telling me when to wake up, when to take a shower, when to eat meals, and having like a full team who would just listen to me go on and on and on about whatever I talked about. I didn't talk about any of this, you know, I didn't talk about anything that actually would have benefited me. You know, I talked about politics and, you know, God knows what I talked about, but it doesn't make any sense that I would try so hard to have someone listen to me and then not actually tell them anything, you know, and then just lie and manipulate and lie and lie and lie and lie. I was just a pathological liar. But that's what I did. And when I was in there, like, I never know if I should share this because I haven't heard many people say they can relate to it, but you know, I got on my knees before I came and talked to you guys. And I was like, God, you're in charge of which stories I tell. So I'm just going to go and tell the story that when I was on level 2, I got put into isolation and they said, like, well, take a dollar out of your file and get a piece of candy from the vending machine, the hospital vending machine or whatever. And I said, I want sour Skittles. They've discontinued sour Skittles, but back then they had them. And, like, sour Skittles, like, after you eat them, there's this, like, sour sugar that's, like, left at the bottom of the bag. And I dumped out this sour sugar, and I rolled up a little piece of paper, and I snorted it. And I remember feeling like, oh, like, yeah, like, that's awesome, you know. But it's just, it's very telling, you know, that I was 15 years old trying to get sober and failing. And failing so spectacularly that I would do something that out there just to feel something, you know, not to get high. Like, you can't get high from doing that. But just to, like, even try to check out of right here, right now. You know, it was never about going up or going down. It was always about getting out of right here, right now. You know, like Earl Hightower says, it's all anti-Lisa medication. I just wanted to feel something other than what I was feeling in that moment, you know? And I felt like I just didn't want to be a part of life or to be on planet Earth. And I felt like every decision or choice that I made should take me closer to that goal of not being part of life. But, you know, obviously it didn't work because here I am talking with all of you. Anyway, so... for the next few years, you know, that was my life. And I started doing more serious things. And a big part of that is like that I lost everything that I owned. And all I had left was a mattress. And I also thought that was somehow in my mind, I twisted that to be like glamorous, that I was like a minimalist who like wasn't part of society, you know, or whatever. I was like a hippie who, whatever I thought I was, I don't know. But somehow I thought it was very glamorous that I was just, that all I owned in this world was a mattress. And, yeah, and I attempted suicide a few more times. And like I said, obviously it didn't work. Here I am sharing with you. And I stopped speaking to anyone, and I was completely isolated, and you know, Tom, I shared this once when I was like a year or two sober. He came and spoke at my old home group, and he said there's a dimension of alcoholism where we just completely drop out of society, where we make no pretense of engaging in society. And that was me. You know, I'd never finished the ninth grade, even though I came from this family of like education and stuff. And I did not have a conversation with another human being for like 3 years. And that was just, you know, the doctor's opinion says his alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I don't want to say that session, like somehow I'm so different than every other human on this planet because I'm an alcoholic, even though like 10% of the population is alcoholic, you know, but I'm the worst alcoholic or whatever I thought it was, you know. But anyway, I got sent to a behavior modification facility in Utah, and they, when I had been there for 6 months, they started taking me to AA meetings. And like I said, I had been in, you know, these facilities where they had panels come in, and they had people from AA and people from NA and stuff come in. And I didn't know there was like a difference. You know, I thought they were the same thing back then. I mean, it, not like it would have made much of a difference, but I had never like, I had never been present at an AA meeting. You know, I had never actually listened to what people said, and I had never introduced myself as an alcoholic. And I don't even know why, but like when they said, are there newcomers, I just stood up, and it was such a profound experience that like I can remember where I was sitting in the room. I can remember what I was wearing. I can remember who was sitting at the front of the room. It was such an impactful moment that I stood up, and the words, I'm Lisa, I'm an alcoholic, came out of my mouth. And it was like the second that I said it, it was just like, I knew that it was over. I mean, like in a good way, I knew that the jig was up. I was just like, oh my God, it's done. Like I'm here. I've arrived. And I sat back down, and it was in this church hall. And I was like sitting on the stage in the back, and the people were at the front, like at the back of the church hall. So I was sitting on the stage in the back of the room. And so I sat back down on the stage, and it was like, my butt fit the stage. You know, it was like my butt fit the chair in AA. And I immediately knew it was the same feeling I had when I had that first drink of vodka, that my fists unclench, my shoulders drop, and I could breathe, that I had arrived. I was home. I was like, this is the place that I've been looking for my whole life. And these are the people that I have been looking for my whole life. And this is the first place I've ever felt like I belonged. And again, I know that not everyone has that experience. Like, some people really don't like it when they get here, or they feel like they don't fit in. And I struggle with that too. But that was my feeling, was like, I have arrived and it's over. Like all that horrible, horrible thing, like stuff that I've been living for the past 17 years is just done. And like I said, you know, I don't even, it's not like that's a different chapter of my life. I don't even see it as a different book. It's a different author. You know, I can draw a line in my life before and after December 2005. I am a completely different person. And so my first sponsor started taking me through the steps, and I didn't, like I said, I wasn't sure I was alcoholic. I wasn't even sure I was an addict. I was so delusional. But I didn't know what that meant. And our book talks a lot about that many people are alcoholic, but they don't realize it because they don't actually know what it means to be alcoholic. And she just explained, like, well, when you drink, do you crave more? And I was like, well, I mean, like, I crave alcohol because I'm awake. I mean, don't you? And she was like, well, actually, no. Like, there are many people who don't crave alcohol just because they're awake. There are people who don't crave alcohol at all. And, like, there's this line in the doctor's opinion that says this phenomenon of craving never occurs in the average temperate drinker. She's like, never is a very strong word. You know, there are people who never crave alcohol or who never take a drink and lose control of the amount they take. And I was like, what? Like, that just blew my mind that wasn't normal. I mean, it's honestly, it still blows my mind. Like, I still kind of think that people who don't drink to get drunk are weird, or, I mean, sometimes I'm out at a restaurant and I see people like let these shots just like sit there on the table. And I'm like, you don't deserve that alcohol, man. Like, you freak, you know, what is wrong with you? I can see it evaporating. Like, that's, you're wasting it. Yeah. But that's not normal. If you didn't know it, that's not normal. That's alcoholic, you know, and that separates us from the rest of the population and puts us into a certain class of people who can never safely drink alcohol, or in my case, use many other substances. I can never safely use in any form at all. So yeah, the first step, it was like, okay, I got it. I'm on board. I know that I can never drink again. And again, that was, okay, I don't want to get on my like soapbox, but that was considered controversial at the time. But our literature says it repeatedly, like, ask him if he is done drinking for good instead of is he done drinking just for today. And that, like, again, that was a very profound thing for someone to say to me. Are you done? Like, are you done for good? Like, your family's really sick of your one day. And it took me a minute to marinate, but to be like, yeah, I am done. Like, I'm done for good and for all. Like, I'm ready to make a commitment to really try and do this thing for the rest of my life. Live life one day at a time, but to stay sober for the rest of my life. And when we started going through, like, the four step, you know, I had buried my emotions, like, so much with just so much alcohol, you know, that I couldn't even admit that I had a resentment towards anyone except myself, and which is called self-pity, by the way. But I thought that it made me, like, less self-centered. It actually makes you, like, more self-centered if you have this intense resentment against yourself. I didn't know that. Like, the first word in self-loathing is self. But I thought that it, like, exempted me from being selfish like the rest of you guys, which is also really selfish to think that I'm, like, special and better than everyone. And she's like, okay, well, let's ask a different question. Instead of saying, who do you have resentment against? Let's write down, if you could get revenge against anyone, who would it be? And I was like, oh my God, like, yes, this is going to be an awesome list. And that was a very long list of people. Oh my God. And she was like, oh, and by the way, when we talk about institutions and principles, like, that includes organized religion, that includes the military, that includes political parties. And I was like, oh my God, like, I'm gonna go through all of history. Like, I got resentments against people from thousands of I have a resentment against, you know, Julius Caesar. Like, just insane the number of resentments that I had for the people that I wanted to get revenge against in my fantasy. And of course, she didn't tell me that we were gonna go back and ask, like, well, how did I create the situation? How was I selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking? And at the time, you know, that sponsor, I don't want to say anything against her, because she had something that worked for her, but she asked me to say what was my part in this. And my current sponsor has asked me to never, ever say that, because if I say what's my part, that implies that person has a part, and whose part am I going to think is bigger? You know, like, this isn't about looking at my part, because this is my inventory. Even if someone has done a lot to harm me, it's like the thing within me that will not let go of the resentment is the thing within me. You know, it's not anything that, and if I'm dependent upon other people to, you know, apologize or whatever it is, it's like, what if they don't apologize for 10 years? What if they never apologize? Like, am I going to be miserable for 10 years? Am I going to be miserable for the rest of my life? You know? And again, to skip ahead, my current sponsor, you know, he said there's this part of the four step that we really don't pay enough attention to, that's in between the resentment column, or the first three columns and the fourth column. And it's two whole pages that goes on and on and on about how this world and its people were very wrong, and that I have to really, really realize the futility and fatality of resentments. And it threatens your life like 17 times. It's like, this will kill us. You will die. If we wanted to live, we had to be free of anger. You know, it's fatal. It threatens your life a bunch of times. So he's like, start by really, really realizing that this is going to kill you. The wrongdoings of others will actually kill you. And then it says we were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle and to turn that into a prayer, you know, to say, God, please help me to see this from an entirely different angle. Like, I've spent my entire life sitting in the prosecution box, and now I'm going to cross the courtroom and sit in the defense box. Like, what would I say if I were defending this person? And that's why when I talk about my parents who are, you know, very, very abusive, like, I say that they were suffering from something untreated, and they have so much trauma from their childhoods, you know, and they have all kinds of mental health stuff going on, you know, and it's easier for me when someone is an alcoholic for me to have compassion, but it's like, what if they're suffering from some other spiritual or mental illness that's untreated? Like, why is that any different than someone suffering from untreated alcoholism, you know, that they're spiritually sick, just like me. He's like, so you're not this like well person looking down on a sick person. Like, you're one sick person looking across the aisle to another sick person. And I had so much just, I carried what my parents had done to me just constantly. And I have, you know, sought outside help for it. And I encourage people to do that. So I'm not saying that people shouldn't do that. But the relief that I got from just considering that my parents were sick, that like, if I saw someone throwing up all over the street, you know, I don't enjoy that. It's not pleasant, but I wouldn't blame them. And it also like, it gave me permission to stop taking that personally. Like, I don't have to say I must have done something to make my parents not love me or whatever. Or like, maybe if I had been different, maybe I can seek out that love by acting like this or acting like this. It's like, no, they're sick. They're either unable or unwilling to give love. And we don't really know why. It's really none of my concern or none of my business why someone is unable to do that or unwilling to do that. You know, it's just, and that's why I need a higher power, because I have to look for that love that I need from the higher power instead of from my parents or from romantic partners who look like my parents. Anyway, so yeah, I had a very, very profound experience going through that and doing a fifth step. You know, like I said, I was a pathological liar, and I don't really know what I was so afraid was going to happen if I told the truth, but I know that the reason I lied was fear. It was always fear. And there were things that I had not told anyone, and things about like my sexual orientation, and oh my God, my cat's all up in my stuff, and things about some of the stuff I had done while I was very, very drunk. Like I had, yeah, speaking of my cat, like I had physically harmed my cat when I was drunk once. And that was something that I was going to take to my grave. I was never, ever going to tell anyone that. And I told her, and she didn't like say, get off my couch, I hate you. She didn't say any of that. She just said, you know what? I did all that stuff too. And sometimes when I'm hearing fifth steps, like what happens, sometimes I'm like, yeah, I've done that stuff too. But sometimes people will share things that I haven't done. And I almost wish that I could give them, you know what, I've done that stuff too. But I think what I've been able to give people over the years of hearing a lot of fifth steps is, first of all, I've heard that before. Or I've heard that many times before. You cannot shock me. I've heard it all. And second of all, that I will just tell a sponsee, like, you know what, I still love you. In fact, I love you more because I know you better. And thank you. Thank you for trusting me with that information. You know, thank you for letting me know you better. And sometimes I'll even say, you know, I think that every part of you is divine and beautiful and inspired from God, and you are a creation of God. And to be able to give that gift, you know, that gift that I was given of sharing every part of myself and not having someone run screaming in the other direction, which never happens, by the way, it's a totally, totally irrational fear that I had. And then, step 6 and 7, like, oh, I've been talking a lot about steps 6 and 7, magical, magical, magical steps. I love step 6 and 7, becoming entirely ready to have God remove it all. And like I said, you know, that moment when the words "I'm an alcoholic" came out of my mouth in a full room, I believe that was the moment that I worked step 6, that I became entirely ready, and that God was like, okay, I'm just going to yank you out of this life and put you into this life, and you're going to turn into a totally different person living a totally different life. And steps 8 and 9, you know, no one had ever told me, like, when you feel bad about something, you need to go to that person and say, I was wrong, I'm sorry. Like, it seems so simple, but no one had ever told me that. And when I did something that caused harm to other people, I would just feel really, really bad about it. And then I would try to, like, drink more to punish myself. And most people don't feel very grateful when you're like, I'm drinking myself to death because I feel bad about what I did to you. Like, they don't want you to do that. That actually, like, makes it worse. They actually want you to just, like, admit that you were wrong. And that was really easy for me to understand, that people were like, can you think of times, like, let's look at this long list of resentments that you were like, if only this person would admit that they were wrong, or if only this person would just say they were sorry. Like, that's all you have to do. You have to go to these people. And I didn't have a super long list when I was new. I had a long list in sobriety because I didn't know how to live life. Those are fun amends to make. But I didn't have a super long list, and most of the people I went and made amends to were like, you know, just keep doing what you're doing, that's all you have to do, or whatever. But some of those amends, like, my sponsor was like, you know what, I don't care what they said, you still have to pay the money back. Or, like, if they said just keep doing what you're doing, that means you never cause that harm again. Like, you never lie about this again. You, whatever, you never, like, cheat on someone again, or you never use someone sexually again, because that's what I had done to my high school girlfriend. Yeah, who said it's fine, don't worry about it. You never use someone sexually again. So anyway, you know, when I was 18, and I was like 9 months sober, I got my high school equivalency, first of all, which was like a really big deal because I never finished the ninth grade. And I went on to undergrad and I went to school, and I was sober all through school. And most of the other kids, and I lived on campus, and it was just wild seeing these 18-year-olds, like, just, like, throw down, man. Most of them were, like, just getting into drinking for the first time, and I was, like, I've already, like, almost died, like, 50 times, so I'm gonna hit a meeting over here. And there were so many nights when, like, I would be with these kids who are just getting so drunk, and I would feel so uncomfortable, and then I would go to an AA meeting with these people who were, like, twice my age, who I had nothing in common with, and I would just feel so much more comfortable, just like, oh, I'm back with my people, you know. Like, it didn't matter, you know, it didn't matter, like, what our ages were, or anything, like, or gender or sexual orientation, like, none of that stuff mattered. It was just like we spoke this common language, and I just felt comfortable, you know, among alcoholics, and I felt so just blessed. But I was like, wow, I got all of this out of the way already. Like, I'm already done. You know, I don't have to do any of this stuff that these guys are doing. It wasn't like, oh, I don't get to drink. Like, I wish I could drink. Like, I was like, I'm so grateful I don't have to drink. And everyone else was like complaining about going to class. And I was just so excited that I was in school. I was so grateful I was in school. I was just going to class like, zippity-doo-dah, you know, I got there early, I sat up front, I stayed late, and I was like, oh, I get to study this, I get to study that, and And I ended up working for a senator there, and I can't go into that because it's outside issues, and I'm a big, big fan of our 10th tradition. But I did stuff that felt very, very meaningful to me, and I did stuff that I always, always wanted to do, you know, since way before that other stuff, before I wanted to be drinking dirty martinis in a jazz bar, you know. And I went on to graduate school, and I went to undergrad in Berlin, Germany, at the Free University of Berlin. And yeah, people like to drink in Germany. But the AA community back then was like, it's much, much stronger now. Back then it was not very strong, but it was what I needed. And there were people in those groups who like are still sober today, who I'm still very, very close with today. Yeah, that I'm so moved thinking about, because I did not have a friend in this world. And today I have an entire world. Like, my world is so huge today, and there are so many people who I just, like, I love, like, more than I love myself, you know, who are still sober, who are still a part of my life. Like, maybe some of those guys don't really go to meetings anymore. And sometimes I'm like, what am I still doing here? Like, I mean, I hope that in another 15 years, I'm still sitting here wondering what I'm still doing here. But, you know, those guys, like, they just, that was just such a wonderful gift of sobriety. And I got to say, if you're new to AA, like, you're new in sobriety, like, you got to get buddies. Like, sponsor matters, sponsees matter, but like trudging buddies are like, they're the fruit of life. You know, they're just what make this thing like what it is, you know? And I'm just thinking about some of those people and the fact that they're still sober. And it's like, maybe this thing actually works. You know, I still have those days where I'm like, maybe AA actually works. Like, maybe I'm actually going to stay here this time. Like, maybe this thing has actually worked for me this time. And I hope I never lose that. You know, I hope I never lose that, that gratitude, that sense of miraculousness. And I went on to graduate school, and I got a master's, or I started doing a master's in public policy in Berlin. And this is back when I was with my ex, who, you know, it was love because we both tried to electrocute ourselves. And then I went on to do a master's in international relations in The Hague in the Netherlands. And everything was going really, really just amazingly. Like, it was just like one miracle after another. And I was sponsoring all these people, and oh my God, sponsorship is such an incredible experience. And some of those women that I sponsored ended up being like the kind of example that I myself followed, you know, that I started off like, yeah, I'll sponsor you because I feel sorry for you, or it's what I'm supposed to be doing. And then they ended up actually like being better examples of this program than I am, or pushing me in a direction that I didn't even know I needed to go. And one of those gals, you know, she was like my grand sponsee, and she ended up switching to me, and it was kind of awkward with her former sponsor, my sponsee. But she's like, I don't know. She's just like probably the most selfless person I've ever met in my entire life, you know. And I don't always say this to her face because like I want to, you know, push her to be better. But yeah, just like seeing these examples, sometimes I'm like, I don't even know what these women see in me. And a lot of the time I have a tendency to attract sponsees who have some sort of like crushed ambition. Like, they always wanted to be a writer, or they wanted to be a dancer, or they wanted to go to law school or whatever it is. And to watch like these women pursue those things and start like painting again, start making music again, you know, start writing again. Like, I have a sponsee who does slam poetry every week, and she went to Accra in Ghana, like on an art program. And just watching people come back to life, you know, watching, getting to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous Dead, and not just staying sober, but actually becoming like totally different people, you know, just and realizing everything they've always wanted to do and actually going and doing it. You know, it's just, I feel like one of the luckiest people on the planet that I get to be a part of this. Like, we, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we see miracles all the time, and it can get, we can forget, you know, what a miracle everything is. But, and I don't like take credit for that. I don't say like, oh, I brought that girl back to life. Like, I'm just along for the ride. You know, I'm just grateful that I get to be a part of it. So anyway, you know, everything went really, really well. I'm out of time. Until I was 11 years sober, I hit a bottom in sobriety, and had to have another new experience, quit my job, quit my relationship. Gave up being one half of the AA couple, which there's like so much ego in that. And in the last 4 years, you know, I've been back in Los Angeles. I had to move halfway across the world and like, but it, and I got sick. I got a brain tumor, but it's been like truly one of the best things that's ever happened to me, because it's freed me from things that I didn't know were causing me harm. Like, I had all these things in me that were blocking me from God, like the job, the money, the prestige in AA, you know, the relationship, all of that. And like, God was like, okay, I'm going to take it. I'm going to take the job, the money, the guy, the speaking all over Europe, you know, and I'm going to plop you down here where nobody knows who the F you are. And you're going to have to start over in Southern California, which is actually a great place to start over, I got to say. And it's been amazing the last 4 years. It's been like the most, it's been just as magical as early sobriety. You know, it's been like the most awake, the most connected, the most happy I've ever felt in my life. And I know that this too shall pass, and there'll probably be another bottom in sobriety somewhere along the line, but I'm just enjoying it while I'm here. And, you know, if you're new, like, maybe we can help you. You know, I don't want to say this program will work. I believe that it will. And we love you, and we want you here, you know, and if you're suffering, you know, it's not forever. It's not forever. And just stick, you know, just stick, because miracles really, really do happen in this program every single day. Thank you for letting me tell my story.